Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts. Here's Daniel's prompt.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So we have discussed some very interesting hardware on the podcast to date, at least for folks who find high-spec hardware interesting. We've talked about the difference between desktops and bona fide workstations. We've talked about mainframes, how the mainframe, or the big iron, is still a thing. Still exists and actually still drives a substantial amount of, I guess you could say, the world, or at least the world's data flow. But at the very pinnacle of the totem pole of big computers with beefy hardware are the supercomputers. I'd love to get into that topic today and talk about supercomputers. What exactly is a supercomputer? What is the kind of threshold for entry when a computer is considered to be in that category? And is there a ranking system? What's like the biggest and best supercomputer in existence today? And if we can agree upon some kind of categorization, how many supercomputers are out there in the world? And what do they do? Weather forecasting comes to mind for me, but then I'm not exactly sure when we talk about supercomputers, why they are still on-premise. Although I guess I asked the same question about mainframe. We have a lot of very, very powerful hardware being developed and deployed in the context of cloud computing, but clearly not everything is being run that way. And I guess if you really want to get into it or think about it, the difference between a on-premise server and a cloud computer really just comes down to who manages it and what the terms of access are. So maybe that's a pedantic point, but it is a deployment model that I think has some significance, and presumably these supercomputers are not exactly the kind of thing you just go out to your nearest tech store to pick one up and get one going. And of course, we have to talk about the other propositions in this podcast. How far could you get if an individual with a very significant budget, certainly not me, was intent on building their own mega computer and lived in an average size apartment in a city, let's just say. How far could you get? How big of a computer is it really practical and possible for your average home user to buy? And if you wanted to build yourself your own supercomputer, at what point would you probably say, I'm giving up, or your neighbors would come hammering on the door wondering why your apartment was 60 degrees Celsius and there was a constant whirring noise of fans coming from it? Over to you, Herman and Corin. Let's talk about supercomputers in another episode of My Weird Prompts.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to My Weird Prompts. We are at episode 275, which feels like quite a milestone, doesn't it? I am Corn, and I am sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother.
Herman Poppleberry at your service. 275 episodes? That is a lot of talking, Corn. I think we have covered everything from the history of buttons to the future of neural interfaces. But today, our housemate Daniel has sent us a prompt that gets right back to the heavy metal of the tech world.
It really does. Daniel was asking about the giants of the computing world, specifically supercomputers. He wants to know what they actually are, how we rank them, why they are still physically sitting in specialized buildings instead of just being in the cloud, and most importantly for the tinkerers out there, how close can a regular person get to building one at home before the neighbors start complaining about the heat?
I love this topic. It is one of those things where the scale is so vast that it almost becomes abstract. When we talk about supercomputers, we are talking about machines that can perform more calculations in a second than a human could in millions of years. It is the pinnacle of human engineering, really.
So, let us start with the basics. What is the actual definition of a supercomputer? Because my phone is faster than the supercomputers of the 1980s, but I do not call my iPhone a supercomputer. Is there a specific threshold or a line in the sand?
That is the tricky part, Corn. The definition is actually relative. A supercomputer is simply a computer that is at the current leading edge of processing capacity. It is a moving target. In the 1960s, a machine that could do 1 million instructions per second was a supercomputer. Today, your smartwatch can do that without breaking a sweat. If you want a technical threshold, we usually look at the top 500 list. That is the gold standard for ranking these beasts.
To you can come get ours with anyone at all at the end of the year. Petaflops. Let us break that down for people who might not spend their weekends reading hardware benchmarks. A flop is a floating point operation per second. Basically, an arithmetic calculation involving decimals. One petaflop is 1 quadrillion of those per second. That is a 1 followed by 15 zeros.
Exactly, and the top machines now are in the exascale range. An exaflop is 1 quintillion operations per second. That is a 1 followed by 18 zeros. To put that in perspective, if every person on Earth did one calculation every second, it would take the entire global population about 4 years to do what an exascale supercomputer does in one single second.
That is staggering. So, if the definition is relative, how do we actually rank them? You mentioned the top 500 list. How does that work? Is it just a race to see who has the most processors?
It is a bit more sophisticated than that, though. Raw power is the main metric. Twice a year, in June and November, the Top 500 project releases its list. They use a benchmark called LIMPAC, which involves solving a dense system of linear equations. It is a very math-heavy test that pushes the processors and the memory to their limits. But there is also the Green 500 list, which I think is just as important, 2020-26. That ranks them based on energy efficiency. Because as these things get bigger, they can cure the...
Right, and we have discussed the environmental impact of large-scale computing before. Specifically, back in episode 272 when we talked about optimizing websites for AI bots. The energy cost of all this processing is a massive hurdle. So, how many of these machines are there globally? If the list is the top 500, are there thousands more just below that?
Oh, thousands! Every major university, national laboratory, and large corporation has something that could arguably be called a supercomputer, even if it does not make the top of the list. China, the United States, Japan, and the European Union are the big players. For a long time, the United States and China were neck and neck for the most systems on the list. Interestingly, in the last couple of years, we have seen a shift where some countries are becoming more secretive about their benchmarks for national security reasons.
That makes sense. These machines are not just for bragging rights. They have very specific, often sensitive functions. Daniel asks what they actually do. I know weather forecasting is the classic example, but what else?
Weather is a big one because the atmosphere is a chaotic system with millions of variables. But in 2026, the biggest driver is actually artificial intelligence. Training these massive large language models requires exascale power. We touched on this in episode 27 when we talked about computer use agents. Beyond AI, you have things like nuclear stockpile simulation. We do not do physical nuclear tests anymore, so we simulate them. Then there is genomic research, drug discovery, and material ice. And I'm off page at the deck quite the kit if you had more fire.
It is basically a laboratory that lives inside a silicon chip. But here is the question that Daniel raised, and I think it is a great one. We live in the age of the cloud. I can go on Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud and rent 10,000 virtual machines with a credit card. Why are these supercomputers still on-premise? Why build a specific building with specialized cooling in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, or outside of Tokyo when you could just cloud it?
This is where we get into the secret sauce of supercomputing, Korn. It is not just about having a lot of computers. It is about how they talk to each other. If you use the cloud, your data is traveling over standard data center networks. Even with high-speed fiber, there is latency. In a supercomputer, the interconnect is the most important part. They use specialized hardware like InfiniBand or proprietary systems like Hewlett-Packard Enterprise Slingshot.
So, it is the difference between 1,000 people in different cities working on a project via email versus 1,000 people in the same room shouting to each other across the table.
Exactly. In a supercomputer, the processors need to share data almost instantaneously to solve a single problem. If one processor has to wait 10 milliseconds for a piece of data from another processor, the whole system grinds to a halt. Cloud computing is great for embarrassingly parallel tasks, where you can run 10,000 independent jobs. But for a single massive simulation where every part depends on every other part, you need that physical proximity and specialized wiring.
That makes so much sense. It is about the connective tissue of the machine. I want to dive into the personal side of this what. Daniel can actually build in our house, but before we do that, we should probably take a quick break for our sponsors.
Good idea. Let us see what Larry has for us today.
Let us take a quick break from our sponsors.
Are you feeling sluggish? Does your brain feel like it is running on an old Pentium processor while they're wonged high throzen? It is a revolutionary head-mounted device that uses ultrasonic vibrations to defrachange your thoughts. Simply strap the 30-pound lead-lined helmet to your head before bed, plug it into a standard 240-volt outlet, and let the Brain-O-Matic do the rest. Users report a 60% increase in their ability to well their the rares, the picolitis of the barity to commodate serificri.
All right, thanks, Larry. I'm not sure I want to plug my head into a 240-volt outlet, but the eyebrow side effect sounds interesting.
I will stick to my morning coffee, thanks. Anyway, back to the world of high-performance computing.
So, Daniel's big question. He lives here with us in Jerusalem. He has a room, a desk, and a dream. How powerful of a computer could he realistically build or buy for a typical home or apartment in 2026? At what point does it become a personal supercomputer? And when does it become a fire hazard?
Well, the term workstation has really evolved. Today, you can go out and buy a system with a 64-core processor and multiple high-end graphics cards. If you look at something like the latest NVIDIA Blackwell-based cards or the AMD equivalents, a single high-end desktop can technically outperform the world's fastest supercomputer from 20 years ago.
Right, but Daniel is talking about pushing the limits. Could he build a cluster in his bedroom?
He could. People do this. It is called a Beowulf cluster. You take a bunch of off-the-shelf computers, link them together with high-speed Ethernet, and run specialized software to make them act as one. But here is where he hits the wall that Daniel mentioned: cost, space, and heat.
Let us talk about the heat first. I know when I am rendering video on my laptop, it gets hot enough to cook an egg. If Daniel has 10 machines running at full tilt, what are we looking at?
We are looking at Asana, Korn. A high-end graphics card can pull 400 to 600 watts. If you have four of those in a machine, plus the processor and the rest of the components, you are pulling over 2 kilowatts from the wall. A standard room heater is usually about 1.5 kilowatts, so one high-end personal supercomputer is literally more powerful than a space heater. If he builds a cluster of 5 or 10, he bought 10 for...
And our apartment in Jerusalem was not exactly designed for that kind of thermal load. We would need industrial air conditioning just to keep the room at a livable temperature. What about the power? Can a standard home outlet even handle that?
That is the real bottleneck. In a typical apartment, a single circuit is usually rated for 15 or 20 amps. At 120 volts, that gives you about 1800 to 2400 watts before the circuit breaker trips. So Daniel could realistically run one very powerful machine on one circuit. If he wants a second one, he has to run an extension cord to the kitchen. If he wants a third, he is going to be tripping breakers every time someone turns on the toaster.
I can already hear the arguments about whose turn it is to use the electricity. Sorry, Herman, you can't make toast. I'm simulating the weather in the Galilee.
Exactly. And then there is the noise. Supercomputer components are designed for data centers where noise does not matter. The fans on those things sound like a jet engine taking off. Imagine trying to sleep while a miniature hurricane is blowing through your room 24/7.
So, at what point does it become impractical? If Daniel has a massive budget, say he won the lottery, could he actually buy something that is officially a supercomputer?
There are companies that sell supercomputers in a box. NVIDIA has their DGX systems, for example, They are about the size of a large microwave, but they weigh hundreds of pounds and cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. They are designed to be plug-and-play for AI researchers, but even those usually require specialized power outlets, the kind you use for a clothes dryer or an electric stove.
So, if Daniel really wants to do this, he is probably better off looking at a high-end workstation with liquid cooling to manage the noise, and maybe just one or two top-tier graphics processing units. That gives him incredible power without melting the floorboards.
Precisely. And honestly, for most things Daniel wants to do, like experimenting with local AI models, a single well-built machine is often more efficient than a cluster of older ones. We talked about this in episode 273 regarding the 2026 problem of AI tool sprawl. It is often better to have one very capable tool than 10 mediocre ones.
That is a great point. It is about the density of the compute. I am curious about the future of this. We are seeing these machines get bigger and bigger, but we are also seeing specialized chips. Like, we are not just using general-purpose processors anymore. We have tensor processing units and neural processing units. Does that change what a supercomputer is?
It definitely changes the architecture. A modern supercomputer is a heterogeneous system. It has a mix of traditional central processing units and these specialized accelerators. It is like a kitchen where you have one head chef who is good at everything, but then you have 20 specialized assistants who only chop onions. If you need 1,000 onions chopped, the assistants are way faster than the chef. That is how supercomputers handle AI and massive simulations now.
I wonder if we will ever see a quantum supercomputer on the top 500 list. We have been hearing about quantum computing for years, but it always feels like it is 10 years away.
We are actually seeing the first hybrid systems now in early 2026. Some of the big labs are connecting small quantum processors to their classical supercomputers. The idea is that the classical machine handles 99% of the work, but it offloads specific, incredibly complex math problems to the quantum chip. It is like having a calculator that can solve things that are literally impossible for a normal computer. But we are still a long way from a pure quantum supercomputer.
It is fascinating how we keep pushing these boundaries. It makes me think about the why again. Why do we need this much power? Is it just because we can, or is there a point of diminishing returns?
I do not think we have hit that point yet. Every time we get more power, we find more complex problems to solve. Think about climate change. Our current models are good, but they are still coarse. We can predict what will happen to a country, but we cannot perfectly predict what will happen to a specific valley or a specific city over 50 years. To do that, we need to simulate the atmosphere at a much higher resolution. That requires orders of magnitude more power.
Or medicine. Instead of testing a drug on 1,000 people and seeing what happens, we could eventually simulate the drug's effect on 1 billion different digital twins of human bodies, each with their own unique genetic makeup.
Exactly. That is the dream. A supercomputer that can simulate a human cell at the atomic level. We are nowhere near that yet. The complexity of a single cell is mind-boggling. So as long as there are mysteries in biology, physics, and weather, we will keep building bigger boxes.
It is a bit humbling, really. We build these quintillion operation per second machines, and they still cannot fully simulate a single blade of grass.
That is the beauty of it, Korn. It keeps us curious, and it keeps Daniel sending us these great prompts. I think the takeaway for Daniel is, yes, you can build a very powerful machine at home, but maybe invest in some good noise-canceling headphones and a really long extension cord before you start.
And maybe check the lease agreement for any no industrial smelting clauses. I think that covers it for today's deep dive into the world of supercomputers.
It was a fun one. It is always good to remember that while we talk about the cloud as this abstract thing, it is actually made of physical machines, miles of cables, and a whole lot of cooling fans.
Absolutely. And hey, if you have been enjoying my weird prompts, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a quick review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps other curious people find the show.
It really does. We love seeing the community grow.
You can find us, as always, on Spotify and our website, myweirdprompts.com. We have the full archive there, including those past episodes we mentioned, like episode 39 on batch processing. If you have a weird prompt of your own, there is a contact form on the site. We would love to hear from you.
Thanks to Daniel for the prompt, and thanks to all of you for listening. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Until next time, stay curious.
And keep your eyebrows safe from the Brain-O-Matic.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.